Welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. I wanted to bring Dr. Majid Jaber back onto the program today while he can grab a little bit of internet to talk about the current medical and health situation across Gaza. Dr. Majid, welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you. It's been a while since we last talked. A lot of things happen, you know, day by day here in Gaza. It feels like months.
Yeah.
For how much events, how much change that happens.
Yeah.
And it's unpredictable. Gotta adapt moment by moment and try to figure solutions.
Well, that's why I wanted to have you back on. I mean, so much, you know, decades happen in minutes in Gaza. There's so much, like you said, that happens day to day. Tell us a little bit about what you've been doing lately and where you're speaking to us from. Last time we talked, it was over the summer, you were working to provide medical care to people in various field hospitals, kind of, you know, in the tent areas in Al-Mawasi. But you and your colleagues have been very busy reopening various medical centers that have been bombed or destroyed or disabled by Israeli attacks over the last 11 months. As we reported last week, Al-Shifa Hospital's emergency department has been reopened against all odds, and that's in the north. Tell us where you're working these days and where you're coming to us now.
I am in at the European Gaza Hospital. We have spent a few weeks, if not months, after the evacuation of the hospital. It was a highly inaccessible place, very dangerous to get close by. And so we had a lot of destroyed equipment, missing equipment. We tried to reach out to everyone. We don't have the medication, we don't have the equipment. We're trying to figure a way to make this hospital at least half functioning. It is the most important department, the emergency department in this war. It took us a while. We are slowly gathering staff back again. We reopened the ER department. Thankfully, we gathered the basic equipment to, you know, get it running. And we slowly reopened the surgical department. We had some assistance from some Norwegian doctors, some Norwegian surgeons that provided us with some equipment. I'm really grateful for that. And so, yeah, the operating theater is working again. And then we have medical department. And then, well, with some help with the university, I reopened the pediatric department. So we have some resemblance of how the European hospital was working back again. With that, minus the huge load of patients, of displaced people. You know, during the evacuation, everyone's scared. Everyone left the area. The European Gaza Hospital is still under the red danger zone. There is no safe place here in Gaza. So people are reluctant to come here. People are hesitant. Even people who are living around don't like to move a lot. But sadly, some people stayed here because Al-Mawasi is very crowded. There's no place to even install a tent anymore. And they decided to stay because they had some houses that are partially destroyed, but at least, hey, it's more dignified to live in these places. But sadly, airstrikes, bombardments do not stop. Any person who moves around is a threat. I personally and other staff do not move during the night or evening that much because we're also scared. The drones are very low. The quadcopters, they just watch everything. It's very risky. The last few weeks we've been working tirelessly. We don't have many staff, so people like me and my other co-workers are working 24-hour shifts at a time. Because what's happening right now is we're trying to alleviate the pressure from the previously only functioning hospital in the south, Nasser Hospital. Nasser Hospital is highly loaded, especially that a lot of people coming back to San Yunus from other areas. We're trying to absorb much pressure from these highly crowded areas. We are receiving more emergency cases, either from surrounding areas or from Khan Yunis. We are absorbing a lot of ICU patients, terminally ill patients. We have too many cancer patients here. Patients where, who require organ transplant, kidney, heart transplant, are just not able to leave Gaza to receive their treatment. And this is, well, a theme of misery here in Gaza, that those people, well, they're not a danger to anybody. They're just slowly dying, and we as healthcare workers, we don't can't do anything about it. They can't do anything about it. Those who can do something about it are silent and maybe don't care enough about it. Yeah, it's just we're back to the same theme. We're having a lot of old patients dying of chronic illnesses, those who should receive treatment abroad. And there's nothing we can do here. We're trying to just, like, some analgesia that we got left is not going to do much to them. We're just trying to prolong their inevitable demise, sadly. So long as the borders are closed.
Majid, the amount of humanitarian aid over the last 2 months has drastically dropped, and that includes medical equipment, medicines, basic essentials such as gauze and antibiotics, and as you said, analgesics. I mean, what is it like as a physician who, and I know I've asked you this before, but maybe talk about maybe what's changed for you in the last few months since we've talked about trying to provide basic, correct medical care, of like basic injuries, let alone, after a massive bombing attack, or these rampant skin infections, the real, I mean, the epidemic of hepatitis A. With these limited supplies, how what is a typical day like for you and your colleagues, especially in, in the emergency rooms, in the triage centers?
Absolutely. Let me give you the simplest cases. Let's say that we're trying to care or tend to the wounds of people who were previously injured. Children with burn wounds, people with broken bones and have these the external fixation, metals. These people, these children with burn wounds or any other wounds get infected easily because they're living in dismissed areas. They lack any hygiene equipment to keep them clean. And they come here more often. The wound gets bad because it cannot heal itself. These children get into infections. This bacteria will not stay local. It seeps it through the bloodstream. They get into sepsis. And some of them die because of a simple skin infection. Okay, like what can I do about it? As you said, I need to take care of it. I need to put a lot of the dressings on daily basis. I need to administer antibiotics. And yeah, the last few months, we as Gazans, especially healthcare workers here, are, we're bullied. We're humiliated by the Israelis to just let these simple items go through. There's no justification for that. I'm not going to make a nuclear a weapon out of some gauze and some antibiotics. It just doesn't make any sense. This child, these children are just dying off. And for what? For what reason? And this is the same practice that they're using, let's say, in the West Bank. They shot someone and they prevent ambulances to reach it. They just lay to death and then they let us do something about it, which is to bury him because we just can't do anything. It's just too late. So let's imagine that there's a mass casualty going on where, of course, trying to triage them. So let me give you a hint. The kind of weapons that they're using lately are way worse than they were using previously. Like back then, we had a lot of injured people that we were able to do something about, at least save their lives. And now, it's just, they're dead. It's abysmal. Like you're hearing in news about these weapons that evaporate civilians. We just register them as missing. The families go hectic. They keep looking and digging everywhere, but they can't find anything. It's been really frustrating. You know, as a doctor, I want to help. I want to save lives, but the scale of massacres that they're using, the weapons themselves are just too lethal. We have some cases of people getting poisoned by something we don't know about. Really frustrating. I'm just trying to give you a picture that we can't do something about the simplest of cases. So the worst cases, like injured people are bleeding to death, people with missing bone, missing limbs, people are heavily wounded, are usually not salvageable anymore, even though we were able to back in the day. So that is really so troubling. Now, after the evacuation of the European Gaza Hospital, many co-workers have decided to go to dismissed areas in Al-Mawasi. My family is in Al-Mawasi. Most families are in Al-Mawasi. It's supposed to be the safe area. Again, there's nowhere safe here in Gaza. And these places are really, really dismissed. The organizations love to claim that there's many healthcare, there's many field hospitals, many medical points, but it's not enough. The population is too dense, too crowded, and we need as many doctors in that place. We need as many healthcare centers, medical points, as much as we could. Because there are areas that are just out of touch with the rest of Almaz. Some areas are provided with better access to healthcare than the rest, and this is not the case in the case for the most parts. This is just exception. So, volunteering the I go visit the camps that are near me, people who know that there's a doctor here. You try to provide, you try to get as many dressings, get as many drugs to provide for these people who just can't afford to transfer to these healthcare centers. Transport is really bad. Second of all, we have the issues of a lot of these wounded people aren't able to move around. Either the whole family is killed, either the parents are too sick to move around, or either it's just depression. Just the mental. The Palestinians people, especially here in Gaza, but they're traumatized, they're crushed mentally. They don't bother looking for themselves after themselves anymore. And you can't blame them. I used to check on a lot of pregnant women, and yeah, I hear these stories became a norm of their husbands getting killed, of them losing, their children, and now they have their hope and this child. I mean, her and her husband used to have it, and now the husband is killed trying to get some groceries, trying to get some food. And now she's alone, mentally crushed, trying to take care of herself. Just have this baby, and she doesn't know what to do about the baby. And that's not a case, that's just a theme at this point. There's a lot of these women like this nowadays. And they're anemic, they're ill, they're sick, they lack in many important nutrients and vitamins, and they don't eat well. This is gonna affect the baby, even will lead to miscarriage at some point. Because, well, there are some interesting papers that correlate mental health alone as a factor for miscarriage, other than, well, the malnutrition that is going on already. And then you have children with amputated limbs. These children, well, they're young and innocent, and they can't really process that they can't go abroad and receive treatment. They keep asking me or asking other workers, like, can we get out? Why don't you get us out? What can we do about it?
And these are kids who will need multiple surgeries throughout their lives, especially as they continue to grow. I mean, is there any of that ability to do these necessary surgeries at the European Gaza Hospital, for example? Or where do these kids go to receive these treatments after their limbs have been amputated?
Well, they're supposed to receive treatment from a multidisciplinary team of surgeons, orthopedic, peripheral nerve surgeons, plastic surgeons. These surgeons need to communicate with some kind of a medical organization that needs to provide these, let's say, prosthetics items. It needs to be well adjusted. This is not going on here anymore, sadly. For me, from what I'm seeing as a well, Gaza has been through this, is these surgeries is the least of our concern. These children, they don't want to live anymore, these children are just done. They lack any facial expression when you try to interact with them. They went from being innocent, playful children to just nothing. Shock. And these children are the youngest, so they're gonna outlive most of us. This opens the issue of generational trauma. If these children survived at the end of the day and had families, when these families are gonna be also dysfunctional and that due to the traumas that these well, future parents are having. It's just we don't know what to do about it. We as adults are tired, we're exhausted, we're burned out. We're crushed and under many circumstances, and these circumstances just keep getting worse. But we at least are trying to push forward and get going with things. These kids don't have anything to do. They don't have work to, numb the pain a little bit. They don't have any responsibilities, and they just wanted to play football. And they wanted to, get some bread for their families, and now they're damaged for good. It's just depressing. I mean, depressing is an understatement.
It's unbearable. And half the population of Gaza are children. And Let's talk a little bit more about Almawasi, which is close to where you work at the European Gaza Hospital and where you said your family is sheltering. The Gaza government media office announced on Saturday that it was launching, quote, an urgent humanitarian distress call to save 2 million displaced people in the Gaza Strip before it is too late, coinciding with the onset of winter and the deterioration of the displaced people's tents. Talk to us about the conditions of people in these tents, especially in places like Almawasi, which just, of course, last weekend, Israel bombed, incinerating more than 20 people, like you said, completely evaporating them. Causing craters in the sand of up to 30 feet deep. These are US-made weapons. What are these tents made out of? As the seasons shift, we're almost a year into this genocide, as the seasons shift from the blistering heat now into fall and eventually into rainy, cold winter. What are the conditions for people, and what's the significance of the Gaza government media office issuing this distress call? Do you think it'll be heeded by anybody?
No, of course not. No one cares. We're treated as subhumans by there's most of the governments worldwide. The conditions. The tents are not usually made of, well, let's say, water-resistant materials or anything sophisticated, really. Most of these tents are made of flour bags, some covers, some rugs, something primitive, sewed together. You place some wooden parts, some metal rods, anything you find, and then you have this tent. So it's not water resistant, it's not clean, and it's not stable. If the winter happens, the rains are gonna demolish most of these tents. These camps are gonna be swamped in mud. Rods and these wooden parts that they're using, it's just gonna fall down by the effect of the water and the effect of the mud. It's gonna be a disaster. And most of these people, let's say, rely on bread as a main source of food, and they use these muddy ovens. And these muddy ovens are also gonna fall apart, and now we don't have a source, we don't have a reliable source for food. And no one ha no almost no one has winter clothes. I personally don't have winter clothes. My house was destroyed. I wasn't able to even like evacuate properly, like have my clothes with it. So everyone is just it's just a hot topic nowadays. Like, what are we gonna do in winter? We don't have gas, we don't have shelter, we don't have food, and we don't have clean water, and we don't have anything. We have a huge number of people that need urgent help. And then you go back to the things we talked about previously. There are a lot of sick patients that are bedridden, people who can't move, people who don't have any caretakers. And then you have the issue of, well, there will be increased rates of infections, chest infections, skin infections that don't have any dressings will get infected again. And then you're going to have this crisis exacerbating in many aspects, and honestly, I don't think that there's something that no one's gonna do about it. And I'm just, if someone didn't do about it for 11 months, like, do you expect them to change their minds? They're gonna just say some weird ass slogans. Yeah, we're gonna say the people working to save Gaza are trying to make a peace, well, seriously.
Right, working around the clock for a ceasefire, right?
Oh, yeah, I believe in you.
Majid, can you talk about the attacks over the last few days, especially in the central areas of Deir Belah and Nuseirat? which is not far from where you are, where more than half of the entire Gaza Strip is concentrated. What kinds of injuries have your colleagues and you been seeing? You mentioned that the injuries are different from previous attacks. That maybe they're using different from your medical assessment. What can you say about the kinds of injuries that you're seeing, and if there's been a difference in any way?
I think the impact of these weapons were different than the ones we were used to see at the beginning of the war. Let's say there's an explosion and you were, well, close but not close enough to die instantly. You usually have these shrapnels that are just going to cut through your wounds, but you're still going to have your hand, you know, it's like, you're going to have some bones, some muscles to repair or to will make it viable by any chance. But nowadays, we're just seeing this hand just disappearing. It's just, the impact is just too strong. I don't know what they're using, honestly. Probably no one does. But it's really bad. Before we talk about the Deir el-Balah, I want to tell you that I was there at the sand massacre, you know, the one that created a huge crater. It wasn't close to my place of residence. And days before it, there was another airstrike that was carried by a helicopter, an Apache, something like this. And I was lucky to survive it, honestly. I was seconds away from it. And it's a very crowded camp, one of the camps I work at. Suddenly there were a lot of kids, a lot of people going around. It's supposed to be a safe area. Suddenly you just see this Apache lighting up, sending these missiles. And suddenly this camp that had tents doesn't exist anymore. And we were in shock. And I was shocked. I was just seconds away from just dying, you know, getting killed. And now you have to just absorb this process and remember that, okay, I've worked in emergencies and there's a lot of people screaming. And you get into this dilemma of, usually they hit an area multiple times, right? So if I go right now, I'm just risking myself. But if I don't go now, I'm also risking the people who could have been saved. And you have to make that decision. Well, so luckily that time they didn't hit it another time. Because, well, I don't know. I'm trying to process that kid who got killed instantly. This kid, you know, I don't know him personally, but I used to see him playing around, you know, and he was just trying to get some cellular connection, calling some relatives or something. And he died for no reason. He was killed because he was just there. And it seems that for the last 11 months, they have no regards for any child or woman. Or anyone, really. Like, and same thing in the crate and the huge massacre that happened, where they dropped massive bombs. The MK-84, I suppose. I was like 100 meters away from it, you know. You just question yourself sometimes. Like, isn't this a violation of international law of the Geneva Conventions? You designate a humanitarian zone, and then you try to target it once and once. Over and over again. And we don't have a place to go, mind you. We're not Ukraine. We're not a huge country where we can just go back to safe areas. We're just cornered. No one's cooperating with us. No one's trying to help us. We're just in a corridor. And then there's nothing to do about it. Really, you're a bystander that just keeps getting beat up. for no reason. So that massacre also, I had the friends that were calling me like, "Is that this camp?" I was like, "Yeah," and they just talk to me and they scream. I have relatives there, I have friends there, and then the journey of trying to figure out if they're alive or not starts. We had many people buried underground by the effect of these bombs. We had people that are still missing. The effect of this explosion had blood and flesh falling out from the sky. This is something I can't really explain to you, and you can't just. You have to be there to be there to just realize the scale of, well, horror that we're going through. We had children with amputated limbs, we had a pregnant woman injured, had older people. We had this guy with like this open fracture, his bone was just out of his body, protruding out of his body, and just screaming, my kids, where are my children? What are we supposed to do with this kind of people? What are we supposed to do? Same thing in Deheubarth, same thing in Sayrat. We're just seeing increased levels of misery. We're not seeing any kind of improvement at all. Don't let the well media outlets fool you otherwise. The genocide, this ethnic cleansing, is still ongoing, and they have no regards for children, for women, or anyone else. Nothing. And one day, you try to make peace with yourself that this may be the last day you're living in, because there's nowhere safe. And we don't have any equipment, really. Like back in the at that massacre, I don't have any equipment. We had to tear down clothes to create these primitive tourniquets, stop the bleeding as much as we could. We tried to use metal rods and anything around to stabilize these fractures. But there is so much you can do to prevent that if this if they, these are the weapons they're using.
Majid, I know you're very busy. You said you're working a 24-hour shift at this hospital. What do you want your colleagues in the West, especially in the US, and in Europe, to know about the conditions that you're working in as a physician, as an emergency doctor, as sometimes you put on your field medic hat, your paramedic hat. What do you want them to know? And what is kind of what are you thinking most about these days in terms of the profession that you've chosen? And your duty, your honorable duty to be a doctor right now.
Well, many people here in Gaza decided to become doctors because they, at some point of their lives, lost people and felt helpless. And now they just decide to, get through medicine to help people and try to prevent the deaths in the future and that they're facing, trying to, well, reduce the misery as much as they could, because no one has to fear the pain of losing someone, let alone losing someone during a genocide, from an airstrike, someone who gets shot in the head in front of you. So I lost many relatives and many people, and this is why I decided to become a doctor. And nowadays, with feeling an obligation to work. But we, as healthcare workers, seeing us, are not even allowed to perform that duty anymore. At this state, you have a multidisciplinary team. You have the whole government, the whole place just working and cooperating to just save one life. But here we don't have anything. We don't have the equipment, we don't have the staff, we don't have the facilities, we don't have the medication, we don't have anyone to back us up. And a doctor in the States, say in the resuscitation room during mass casualty, they have one duty. Okay, they have one thing to do at that point because they have a team. But here you have to do many things. This is very stressful. If you do this 1,000 times, you eventually get really strained mentally. And what I want to say to these, to my colleagues at the States, is that imagine yourself here in Gaza at my place. You've got nothing to do and you want to help. You feel completely paralyzed, even though you want to do something. And this is the feeling that many foreign doctors and healthcare workers felt when they came here. They had different expectations. They thought that they're gonna, have really, have some easier times. They didn't expect it to be easy, but really easier. Like during a resuscitation room, they kept looking for monitors, for equipment, and half of them is just not functioning that well. Just chaos, not accurate, and it takes time to perform something that would take 5 seconds in the States, and you keep losing patience, and you try to improve it, but it doesn't work at all. What I expect from my coworkers is to speak up, to raise their voices, to send messages, to their house representatives, to those who can make some kind of a tangible change. Getting these medication, getting these drugs, getting these medical equipment should be a priority during any during this genocide. I mean, during a humanitarian crisis, this is a no-brainer. But nowadays, when it's taken to an extreme, the extremist, we're not allowed to do anything about it. Yeah, please speak up, help us make a change here, and if you can, well, come over. We need some help.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Majid Jaber. You are a physician currently working in the south of Gaza, we'll just keep checking back with you periodically and as often as possible. I'm really, really appreciative that that you took some time out of your very, very busy schedule to talk with us today. Just keep me posted, keep us posted, and our audience is incredibly grateful as well. Thank you so much, Dr. Majid.
Thank you, Nora. I mean, it's really important to provide a platform for Palestinians to speak up about their issues and struggles, and I'm also thankful for that. Thank you so much.
Thank you for all you do.
Thank you.